Hello and welcome to Science Off Camera. I am Sebastian Remy, application scientist at Teledyne Princeton Instruments. In this podcast, I will be speaking with scientists from around the world about their research, advancements they have made, and how they got to do what they do. This podcast is brought to you by Teledyne Princeton Instruments, leading manufacturer of scientific cameras and spectrographs for low-light measurements from X-rays to infrared light. The Nirvana HS InGaAs camera from Teledyne Princeton Instruments is a high-performance scientific camera for infrared optical imaging and spectroscopy, featuring unprecedented speed, sensitivity, image quality, and ease of use. The Nirvana HS enables cutting-edge research for applications from astronomy to deep tissue optical in vivo imaging in the lab and the operating room. Book an online consultation and demonstration at princetoninstruments.com to see how the Nirvana HS camera will fit into your application. In this episode of Science Off Camera, I'm talking to Professor Dave McCammond, Associate Professor of Chemistry at the University of Rochester. Dave and his team investigate what happens during chemical reactions between molecules within times of a millionth of a second or less. I talked to Dave about how he recognized that chemistry is much more than just reactions in a fume hood, what ultrafast spectroscopy is, how it is used to develop new forms of solar fuels, and finally, what equipment in his lab he had to fix after the COVID-19 related shutdowns. What is your current role and what was your way there?
Let's see. So I'm an associate professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester. So University of Rochester is a unique university, and I'm happy to be here because it's a kind of a small university. It's an R1 university. It's a research university, but it has a lot of the characteristics of a liberal arts college at the same time. So we're out here in western New York, up tucked in next to the shores of Lake Ontario and the city of Rochester. I started here in 2006, and so my wife is actually from the area, so I knew about Rochester and was really happy when that spring, when I had a full national job search, that I saw that they had an opening here in the chemistry department. I was pretty excited about that. So after a full nationwide job search, when I was finishing the second year of my postdoc, I got some interviews and I got some offers, and I was really happy to have the opportunity to come to Rochester. It's been a really great place for me to start. I felt like I had really good support from all these senior faculty that really wanted to see me succeed. And they appreciated the science I was doing. So it's been a great place to build a research group and do lots of teaching, of course. But it's been a great place to be. I grew up in Denver, Colorado originally, and then I moved around quite a bit. So I went to college at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and then I took a few years off, which, by the way, for anybody listening, I really recommend. It was a great time to have a couple years of just having a job and not a career. Then I went to graduate school at UC Berkeley. Spent a long time in graduate school. I was one of those grad students that did not graduate in a timely fashion. It took me 7 years to get out of grad school. And then I did a two-year postdoc at Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois, before going on the job market for faculty positions and ending up in Rochester. So I lived a bunch of different places, but I was really happy to land here. So we run a small research group in Rochester, about three graduate students, and anywhere between one to three undergraduates working in my lab. I've had a bunch of postdocs over the years, but none right now. And so we run a research group where we use ultrafast spectroscopy and femtosecond stimulated Raman spectroscopy, and also just traditional CW Raman spectroscopy to study photochemistry of molecules that absorb light and then do something interesting, potentially something useful like for solar energy applications, but also just interesting dynamics that occur once molecules absorb light. So that's sort of where I am, I guess.
In your time off, what was it you were doing? Was it related then to science as well or something completely different?
It was related, and that's what I tell undergraduates when they're thinking about, like, should I go straight to graduate school or should I take some time off? I think that if you take time off after your bachelor's degree, if you do something that's vaguely chemistry related, you're fine applying to graduate school later. If you really leave chemistry entirely behind, you could hurt your later applications to grad school. So I was a technician in a few different labs. So I was in Portland, Oregon, and I worked in a molecular biology lab for a while. And I was I worked in a quality control lab at a malt factory, you know, where they actually make malt for beer companies. That was a really interesting job. I really liked the work they were doing there. And so that was neat to be sort of to see what it's like working in a quality control lab in industry and stuff like that. And then I also worked at Kodak back in Rochester as a technician for a while also. So all those jobs were sort of analytical chemistry kinds of jobs. And so I did keep continuing to do chemistry before I went to grad school, and that worked pretty well for me. It kind of meant that when I went to grad school eventually, after those 2 years off, I was really choosing to go to grad school. Like, I really was like, oh yeah, I want more opportunities to design research programs. And so I was excited to try and get my PhD.
Chemistry was always something you are interested in?
Yeah, it has been. It's been, I've been pretty steady as it being my primary interest. These days, actually, when I teach general chemistry, like I teach, each spring I've been teaching general chemistry to freshmen at the U of R. And I have noticed that I really like teaching the physics part of general chemistry. So teaching about quantum mechanics, wave particle duality and all that kind of thing is something I really enjoy. And so part of me does think, oh, maybe I should have gone into physics. That's really a neat area. But like many people, I felt like my math skills were good enough to be a good physical chemist, but maybe my math skills are not good enough to be a good physicist. my physical chemistry colleagues might be insulted by that. But as an experimental physical chemist, you can get by with a little bit less in the math department.
Okay, so often when you think of chemists, you think of people who stand under the fume hood. They mix together crazy chemicals, right? But there's this whole other, and that's definitely still what a lot of chemists do, but there's this whole other side where you do what you do, kind of do cutting edge, like optics and laser systems and things like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the, as an undergraduate, I did get involved in physical chemistry and spectroscopy. So early on, I was able to recognize that, wait a second, chemistry is much more than chemical reactions and running reactions in a fume hood. For much of a chemistry department, that's what people really love doing. They want to make molecules. That's their goal as a synthetic chemist. But early on, I realized, just because the professors that I had, that there's a lot of fun work in chemistry that's really trying to study how molecules move around, what's their structure, how do they interact with their environment, how do they exchange energy with the environment, all those kinds of studies that really are important for understanding material and understanding chemical systems, but it doesn't involve really any synthesis at all. So I don't do any synthesis. The only synthesis that I do often is 5-minute epoxy. So we have to do polymerization reactions with epoxy because we have to glue optics into mirror mounts sometimes. So that's about it.
Can you talk a little bit more about what ultrafast spectroscopy actually is and how you use it to study photochemistry? How is it useful? And I believe there might be a lot of people who don't know a lot about ultrafast optics and things like this. So what is it exactly kind of you're doing, and how does it help you understand photochemistry? Maybe you have a specific example.
Yeah. So this is an interesting area of chemistry that I really love, and it's something we think about every day, but it is not necessarily something that most chemists are thinking about. So we study photochemistry, which is really any reaction that starts when molecules absorb light. So to study this kind of reactions with spectroscopy, basically you need a way to initiate that chemistry, sort of a, what you think of as the starter's pistol to start things going. And then typically you need to come in after you've started the reaction by exciting it with one laser pulse that the molecules in the sample absorb, and then they start to do their chemistry. After that point, you need to come in with some other laser pulses to observe them. And so we call that the probe. And so that initial excitation is what we call the pump. And this is, this overall area is often called pump probe spectroscopy, with the idea that your molecules are just sitting around in a glass cuvette in the ground state. You can hit them with a big laser pulse. The molecules absorb that light and they start to do whatever they're going to do. And then at some time delay later, you come in with probe laser pulses to probe the state of those molecules after they've, you know, reacted. So some of the common things you might think of are like with photosynthesis. You might be probing chlorophyll, and you might be, you know, chlorophyll is green because it absorbs red and blue light. So you could hit that sample with a red laser pulse or with a blue laser pulse. The chlorophyll would absorb that light. And if it's in a reaction center or something that's going to be photoactive, you could initiate electron transfer from that chlorophyll in the protein. And you could monitor that electron transfer event by ultrafast spectroscopy. So the ultrafast lasers are useful because they're useful because really eventually you need to make really short laser pulses. That the ultrafast photochemistry of things like electron transfer in photosynthesis, or electron transfer that's useful for solar energy, those events happen on the picosecond timescale. So picosecond is 10 to the minus 12 seconds. That's a millionth of a second. And it's a very difficult time scale to probe with traditional laser pulses. So you really need to work hard to make these femtosecond laser pulses. So the laser pulses on our table start off at about a 100 femtosecond duration, and then we do a variety of nonlinear optics to compress them typically down to 20 to 30 femtoseconds. With those pulse durations, you can really have a really almost instantaneous initiation of the photochemistry, and you can get really good time resolution to probe the events that occur really quickly after those molecules absorb light. So you can probe the molecules at 50 femtoseconds, 100 femtoseconds, 200 femtoseconds immediately after they've absorbed light, when they're doing a lot of really interesting dynamics. And so the femtosecond laser pulses give you that time resolution, that ability to probe really fast events, much faster than any other kinds of spectroscopy could do. So, you know, I guess in general, the kinds of things we're thinking about a lot are changes in molecular structure. So, you know, the structure of molecules is determined by the electrons that are in a particular configuration in that molecule, holding it in a particular geometry. And when you excite one of those electrons to an excited electronic state, the molecule then rearranges its geometry a little bit. You know, usually it's not a huge dramatic change, but it changes structure, and that can really affect the electronic structure of the molecule. So you have this feedback between molecule absorbs light, and then it goes into this excited electronic state, and then it changes its geometry, and the change in geometry can then initiate changes in the electronic structure. So that's called a broad area of non-adiabatic dynamics, where changes in the structure is really driving photochemical reactions to occur. And so we're really interested in that kind of thing. And those structural changes in those molecules can happen on a really big range of timescales. So we're interested in those initial events that are sort of occur in less than 100 femtoseconds, and then even long scale non-radiative decay back down to the ground state that might take one nanosecond. That's the sort of the range of time delays that we're interested in, or sort of femtosecond to nanosecond dynamics.
Have you worked yourself on photosynthesis, or what are the specific areas you study with ultrafast spectroscopy?
I've done a little bit of work in photosynthetic systems, usually through collaborations, but most of the work we're doing right now is related to artificial photosynthesis. So we're interested in designing molecular systems that can make a solar fuel. So if you think of photosynthesis as absorbing light to initiate the production of things like sugars from plants on the surface of the earth, We would be interested in designing artificial systems where molecules absorb light that initiates electron transfer, and then eventually those electrons are combined with protons in an aqueous environment in water in order to produce hydrogen. And so we're interested in making hydrogen H2 as a solar fuel and initiating that process by the absorption of light. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk over the years of that sort of a futuristic hydrogen economy where we could get away from burning fossil fuels and use hydrogen as a fuel source that where you burn hydrogen or you run it in a fuel cell. The only byproduct is water, so this is much better for global warming issues. The problem right now is that all the hydrogen that's produced in the world is generated from hydrocarbons. So it's not actually a sustainable energy source the way we do it right now. So there's a lot of work going on in chemistry labs around the world trying to imagine how can we split water into hydrogen and oxygen so that we can use that hydrogen as a fuel source for a more sustainable energy grid.
Nice. This sounds really interesting. How far are people able to do this already? Or where is the field currently? Are you able to produce hydrogen kind of in the lab or grow it kind of in this way?
Yes, it is. This is difficult engineering. So I would say that it's at the point where there's some really good work that can make this happen. Right now, the most efficient systems are actually really separating the solar energy production, which is just from an advanced solar cell like you might have on your roof. So you generate electrical power, DC electrical power, and then you use that flow of electrical current to drive an electrolyzer that would split water electrically. And so those are the most efficient systems we have now, but it has yet to be proven whether or not they can be really developed on a large scale, or if they're one of these sort of dead ends where forming those electrocatalysts that can split water, given a DC power source, maybe those are only systems that can work on a small scale. But so far things are scaling up well, and it seems like people are gonna be able to do this in the future, that this could be a very useful way to make a fuel. So in my lab, we actually don't do that much engineering of like thinking about, well, how could we actually make this work for the world? The systems we work on in my lab are much more, for lack of a better word, esoteric, I guess, that we have a molecular system that where we can really probe what fundamental processes are controlling the efficiency of all these different events. How efficient can we make the molecule to semiconductor electron transfer? How efficient can we make sure that electron that's now in a semiconductor conduction band, that electron actually gets to a catalyst in order to produce hydrogen? So we have a really good working system that's useful for really studying the fundamentals of each one of these steps, but it's a very reductionist perspective, that we're really thinking about the efficiency of these individual steps and not the overall engineering of actually how we're going to make this work overall. So we're leaving that to other labs.
So your measurements would help a molecular engineer actually simulate the systems before they actually build them and be more efficient in their work?
I think they would. But the other thing is that in terms of molecular design also, it would allow you to design dyes that absorb light where you know, okay, this is a dye that's going to be really efficient. And it's going to be really robust. We need dyes that can do this reaction billions and billions of times in a row and not fall apart. So, you know, most dyes that we use, like when you leave your shirt out in the sun for a couple of days, it gets bleached, right? It kind of, that dark red shirt is no longer dark red when you bring it in. That's because the dyes have been damaged. They've been oxidized typically from all the photochemistry that happens. So we need dyes to do this that are much stronger than that. And so those are the kinds of things we can study, is how do we best balance making a molecular dye that absorbs the solar spectrum really efficiently, but also doesn't get damaged from that photochemistry. And then also, so in our systems, what we're thinking about is really those dyes are absorbing, molecular dyes are absorbing light, and then they're transferring electron to a semiconductor nanoparticle. So the surface morphology, that means just the surface structure of that nanoparticle, can really influence how it behaves. And so what we'd like to do, this is what we currently have a National Science Foundation grant to do, is to really understand how the sort of nooks and crannies of that nanoparticle surface can control whether it's working efficiently or not. And so with those, with answers to those kinds of questions, somebody who's assembling an overall system would have a better understanding of like, okay, we need to care about this, but we don't need to worry about that when they're designing an overall or engineering an overall system.
So you mentioned ultrafast spectroscopy, and mm-hmm. setting up these ultrafast laser systems is really challenging, right? We deal with these mind-boggling timescales. So how far, and I still remember when I went to the university and how difficult it was to set up these systems, etc. I've never worked myself on that, but friends of mine mm-hmm. have. So how is the situation today? How long does it take us students? Is it much easier? Are there now more automated systems around? Is it a lot of fine-tuning by mm-hmm. hand and building it up all yourself? How far along has this field kind of gotten?
It really, it really depends what lab you're in on what kind of system. So definitely over the time scale of my career, like I started grad school in 1997. And so at that point, all femtosecond laser systems were really home built. There were some commercial systems coming into play. And now you can definitely buy an entirely commercial system where the whole femtosecond laser system is a commercial product and the transient absorption optics are all a commercial product. And so you can be up and running, you can be collecting spectra by the end of a week after the installation process has begun. So those options are definitely out there. And that goes all the way through the detection also. So that's production of all the specialized femtosecond laser pulses could be all done by commercial products. And the data collection could also be all managed by commercial products. In my lab, we take a much slower route, perhaps less efficient. So we have a commercial TISAF laser from Spectrophysics that produces our, basically we get a train of laser pulses that with a rep rate of 1 kilohertz. The pulses are each 100 femtoseconds long, but they're at 800 nanometers. So it's not a particularly useful wavelength for photochemistry. So we then have a whole home-built laser table. So we have built all of our own optics that convert that wavelength into wavelengths that are more useful for us. So we're producing visible wavelengths from blue through red with a non-collinear phase-matched OPA, and we've built all that ourselves. We do all the frequency doubling and frequency tripling to produce ultraviolet light too if we need that. So we were studying DNA photochemistry for a long time. DNA absorbs ultraviolet light, and so you need a lot of UV laser pulses. So we've built all those optics ourselves. And on the probing side too, we make a white light continuum to be probe pulse, and then we make a variety of picosecond laser pulses also. So we're both compressing the pulse and stretching out the pulse and generating different wavelengths, all with our custom optics on the table. What that means is that in my lab, actually developing those techniques of doing that kind of thing is a little bit more of the job as opposed to just applying the technique. So there are other labs where they really just need the photochemical results. And so they might go in and just get a full commercial system so that they can run experiments as efficiently as possible. Whereas in my lab, we tend to be pushing the envelope about how to make these experiments work better. And so we're constantly rebuilding our laser table to make it more efficient or to generate new wavelengths that we might need and to do different kinds of experiments. So since it's all home built, we get it's easy for us to do that, to strip it down and rebuild it in different ways all the time. So my students get a lot of experience in that kind of optical work, even though they're all getting chemistry PhDs. Often I say that the reason we get paid to do this is because we're studying chemistry. All the big questions that we're answering are chemistry questions. but the tools we use are really from optics and from nonlinear optics. So we sort of sit at a place where we're translating new optics and techniques that are published in optical journals and translating those into new tools for chemistry. It's definitely a tough learning curve. So it's rare to have a chemistry graduate student come in who's done much spectroscopy like this before. Extremely rare. So often when I'm introducing people to the laser or I'm trying to recruit graduate students, the first thing I tell them is, don't worry, nobody's ever done anything like this before. We'll train you once you're here.
So when we talked last week to set this up, you said that you just were able to go back to the labs, right, after the whole coronavirus shutdowns, etc.
Yeah.
So how has that last couple months been in your lab? You have a fairly small group. Like, how have you guys held up, and how have you been doing kind of in that time as a group?
Yeah, it's been definitely a weird time. So we shut down around March 20th. It's a very rapid series of events, right? So I think everybody across the country had this very rapid succession of like, oh, we're going to have to be careful. And then like 2 days later, oh, wait, school's canceled. And then 2 days after that, oh, wait, work is canceled also. And that was really played out fast in Rochester also. So very quickly transitioned from me talking to my group about, okay, we're going to have to be careful and make sure that we're cleaning surfaces, but it's okay because we're a small germ pool, just the four of us, to the university deciding that they, in order to keep everyone safe, they really needed to just shut down campus entirely. So the undergraduates were sent home, and even graduate students weren't allowed to come in to do work. So it was tough for a couple weeks, for a couple months, I should say. It really depended on the grad student. So I had one student who was studying hard for a master's exam, and so he was busy with that. I had another student who was doing a lot of theoretical work, and he was doing great because he had a ton of theoretical work he could do. I had another student who was just about to jump on the laser and collect a ton of data. And so he went into quarantine basically with no data in hand to work on. And so it was much, much more frustrating for him, I think. So it really depends on which student you're talking to. Some people are able to work from home and do what they need to do to sort of advance their projects. Other people at the university were really stuck. Like, they really needed to be in lab collecting data, and that wasn't possible. So, so 2 weeks ago, we got clearance to head back into the lab, but they're doing really strict distancing. So they're working hard to keep the overall building density down and the local density in each lab down, both of those. So my lab being small, we're working in two-person shifts and sort of trying to balance things that way. And we're trying to get back in. One of the problems with these femtosecond laser systems is that they don't necessarily do well just being shut down and left for 2 months. Our laser basically ran 24/7 for about 10 years. Because it was so stable. If you run it just continuously without shutting down, it's an extremely stable laser system. But then being shut down for 2 months, it has big problems getting back up to speed now. So we're doing a lot of troubleshooting and getting some, having to fix a bunch of lasers and other instruments in lab that didn't fare very well.
Is this the first thing you or your students checked, or where your mind went to when you could go back to the lab? I have to get the laser back up running.
Yeah, absolutely. So, that's the big challenge now, is to get everything running there. There's other things that don't quite make sense. There's other pieces of electronics that have also broken being shut down for 2 months, but it doesn't really make sense for them. Like the lasers, there's a lot of different sort of thermal effects and humidity effects that means that they have problems being shut down. But there's other instruments that have broken also. We're not quite sure why. It doesn't quite make sense that they broke at this time, but they did. So,
yeah, it's interesting. I find it really interesting how people have to adjust themselves and how motivated kind of everyone is kind of to deal in a positive way with the situation, right? There's not much one can do about it, and how people even adjust it just outside of work. I mean, there has been trends, and there have been movements kind of to move certain things you do as scientists online, right? One is kind of the way you meet, etc. And I've seen already before this whole quarantine situation started, there were things like online conferences, etc., people experimented with. So do you see things like that staying around and getting more attention now? Do you see that in your field also, that people are starting now to meet online, move conferences online, and do you think that will stay that way, or how will that impact kind of the future, how you do science, essentially, right?
I agree. I do think that we're seeing that, and I think like you said, that this is going to be sort of initiating a broader trend of moving things online. And it could be, you know, for my profession, it could be that the idea of going into the lab every single day, whether you're doing lab work or not, maybe that's going to go out the window. Certainly for the next year, things will be coming back slowly, and think there will be a lot of online conferences. In our department, we're talking about trying to invite speakers. Usually we have a really vibrant speaker program where scientists from around the world are invited to campus, and they give a lecture and they meet with faculty and students throughout the day. But that's going to be on hold for a while. But hopefully one thing we can get going is really good online conferences or online speakers, where we can invite scientists that we want to get to know, and they can come and do a Zoom presentation or that kind of thing. And so hopefully there will be some benefits of really talking to more people because of the flexibility of online conferencing. I was involved with a big conference in Rochester in the fall. The Northeast Regional Meeting of the American Chemical Society was going to be in October. Our executive committee really struggled with how to handle that, and eventually we decided that we had to postpone it because we decided that in October people wouldn't be, it wouldn't be safe yet to have those kinds of big in-person conferences. So we postponed to 2022. I think it will still be a great conference at that point, but it's really hard to put in work for literally years trying to make this conference happen, and then in the end have to postpone it like this. It's unfortunate. So we thought about doing an online conference for that also, but at the time we really decided that a lot of the good things that we wanted out of the conference, the kind of casual interaction that you get at a conference of meeting colleagues and talking to people, that really couldn't happen very well in a virtual environment. But now I've seen some things online, and I've seen some different modalities of doing this, and I'm starting to get more comfortable, and I think other people are also getting more comfortable with the idea of virtual conferences. And so it seems like it's going to be a bigger trend.
Let me ask you one more question. If you could choose whatever you wanted to work on, kind of start it all over again, what would be something you would be interested doing now? Would you be most fascinated doing kind of the same things you have been doing, or what fascinates you now that you could get into?
I'm really happy doing that. I love this kind of science that I'm doing. So it's, I like the idea of the question where, okay, if I couldn't do this, what else would I do? If I had to start over again, I feel like I've been pretty lucky and happy with this field, so maybe I'd just do this again. But if I couldn't do this, there are two areas. One thing, so for this kinds of science, for thinking about solar fuels, I really like electrochemistry, and I don't know enough about electrochemistry, and I'd like to know more. So if I could be an inorganic chemist, maybe studying metal oxides and electrochemistry, that would be really cool. Thinking about it more broadly, you know what I'd really like to do is astronomy. I think that would be really amazing to do the kinds of astronomical spectroscopy. I think that would be fantastic to really study the emission spectrum of stars and predictions about other planets and things like this. That's an area that I really love because it's sort of a combination of the kinds of spectroscopy I'm interested in about how light interacts with matter and how matter produces light, but using that for really big existential questions in the universe. So that would be a lot of fun.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for getting on the podcast today and for the interesting conversation. I had a great time and it was really interesting. Thank you so much, Dave.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to talk.
Thanks again to my guest, Professor Dave McCammond. Check out the show notes to find a link to his lab website where you can find out more about his exciting research. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider following Princeton Instruments on social media for more episodes. We also host episodes that focus more on scientific imaging in the life sciences, partnering with Teledyne Photometrics. Follow them on social media to see when the next episode is released. Check out PrincetonInstruments.com for the latest in scientific camera and spectroscopy technology for physical and life sciences, such as the Isoplane 81 spectroscopy system. See you next time and stay safe.